in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host is Vicki Nichols-Goldstein, who's on break from her extensive travels. Hey, Vicki.
Hello, and welcome, everyone.
So today we're happy to be speaking with Reverend Robert Wilkins, Executive Director of the Seafarers Ministry of the Golden Gate at the International Maritime Center, which is near the port of Oakland, California. The ministry is committed to seafarers' wellness, maritime promotion, and community connectedness. Robert Wilkins himself is an ordained minister of the Baptist Churches USA with extensive studies and degrees in theology, social theory, and business. He served both in pastoral roles and as longtime CEO of the East Bay YMCA, as well as an affiliate professor at the Berkeley School of Theology. But most of his present time and commitment is to the world seafarers. They come into ports like Oakland and are surrounded by usually low-income communities. But before we can speak with the Reverend Williams about those things, we have some blue news you can use. Today's blue news is utterly amazing. Yes, those terminally cute, voracious marine weasels, the sea otters, are back in the news again. As you may or may not know, the northern sea otters made an amazing recovery from 18th and 19th century slaughter for their fur, now number some 120,000, with more than half of them in Alaska. But the southern otter, the California sea otter, that once was thought to be extinct, has only recovered to about 3,000 animals, and that population hasn't grown in decades. They think that's related to sharks, pollution, and other factors. So in 2020, Congress directed the Fish and Wildlife Service to study the feasibility of relocating some otters to their historic range in Northern California and Oregon. The public planning process resulted in a $40 million relocation plan. But now the Trump administration has begun slashing budgets for many federal agencies, including a proposed $800 million cut to fish and wildlife. The LA Times is now reporting a new private sea otter fund has been established with the support of a Silicon Valley donor, no doubt, to continue the plan for otter relocation. It's raised close to $1.5 million to date, with the goal of raising the $40 million that may not be there in the federal budget. A recent calculation puts the value of California's marine mammals, in terms of whale watching, otter tourism, and the like, at upwards of $1 billion or more. So let's thank those adorable otters for all the ecological services they provide, as well as the joy they bring both to the people making money in ecotourism, but also the spiritual joy of seeing them in the wild. And speaking of which, welcome, Reverend Wilkins. We usually first ask our guests about their original connections to the sea. So let me ask you what yours were.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thank you for the blue news that I can use. One of the amazing things about maritime is that you're always learning something new. I grew up in Kentucky, so my encounters with the water were the Ohio River, which were kind sometimes, but mostly onerous. The first time I came to California, I was in junior high school, and we rode all the way down Wilshire Boulevard until you finally get to Ocean Boulevard, and there in front of you is Santa Monica Beach in all of its glory and just water everywhere. And that was absolutely breathtaking. I will never forget that. And every time I'm in Los Angeles at that point, I remember my first encounter. It was just absolutely captivating and amazing, mainly because of just how big it was. There was ocean to the left, ocean to the right, and ocean in front of you farther than you could point. And that was just very amazing and breathtaking.
That sense of being part of something larger than yourself.
Once you got there, you ended up obviously spending your life in the maritime ministry. So what were the next steps that took you on your journey?
Well, I've been in ministry for many years, ran away from it forever, all growing up. And I was a church kid. I grew up in the South, so we went to church every Sunday and so forth. Everybody anticipated that he's going to be a minister, because I was the kid that they always picked to read the scripture or to make announcements in church and so forth and so on. And I was determined that's not what I'm going to do by any stretch of the imagination. Long story short, I did end up going into ministry because it was my calling, it was my destiny, and you can't get away from it. St. Paul says in scripture, woe unto me if I'm not a minister, because that was what I was equipped to be. And my brand of ministry, rather than a parish pastor in a particular church, I'm much more a pastor to the world. I'm fascinated by the spiritual dimension of anything and everything, and am well situated to bring religious and spiritual values and sensibilities into business, into service, and other dimensions. And so the YMCA was the perfect career for me, where I had the opportunity to run a relatively large and complex corporation. So dealing with business, dealing with risk management, human development, social problems, and so forth and so on, but had permission to come from a faith-forward, values-based position. And that ended up being the perfect thing for me. And I did that for 30 years. That's the total career that I had. At the same time, I was always interested in business. And so through my career, I got business education. I went to the Stanford Graduate School of Business, the USC Marshall School of Business, picking up various degrees and certificates and so forth. So when it came time for the people in the Seafarers Ministry to look for somebody that might be suitable for what their needs were, I was a good fit. I am an ordained minister. Most of my degrees are theological degrees. I am an affiliate professor at the Berkeley School of Theology, as well as having run large, complex organizations. And so I was a mark for them. And they kept bugging me, actually, because I had told them, no, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to sit back and be slow about it. But as they continued to haunt me, and I said, okay, either they are the devil incarnate who won't leave me alone, or this is a legitimate calling. So let me investigate. And I began to study maritime and the ocean and so forth and so on. And I was absolutely fascinated and gobsmacked. First of all, just in terms of the size and scope of the industry and all of those dimensions and so forth. But then I was a little bit reluctant because I said, you know, this doesn't really relate to any of my experience or my interest. It doesn't really relate to, you know, what I was interested in terms of social issues in the why, nor has it been any of my focus as a theologian and professor and so forth. So let me dig a little bit deeper and kind of figure out what's the connection for me personally. As I begin to look at the connections with me personally and this Seafarers Ministry, there were some real significant personal connections. Not only was I interested in it, I knew I could do the work because I can do any of that kind of work. But first of all, I remembered the YMCA connection with seafaring. The YMCA was founded in London, England in 1844. It came to the United States in 1851 by Thomas Sullivan, who was a sea captain. He was a merchant marine, and he brought it to Salem, Massachusetts. And I was like, oh my goodness, what a connection here and there. So I begin to feel kind of personally that, okay, this makes some sense for me. And then I also begin to think I was really getting back into ministry full time. And I was like, okay, what's the connection with ministry? I don't really see it. And I live in the Oakland Hills and I see water all the time. And I was sitting there one day and it struck me that you follow this Jesus guy was actually, and his group, they were seafarers. Jesus and his posse were fishermen, and the bulk of his ministry happened along the seashore. And I was like, okay, I hear a message, you know, coming to me directly that this is something for you to be involved in. So again, it was a combination of my interest as a faith-forward person. And here was an organization that was about ministry, helping people and dealing with social issues related to maritime and the ocean, as well as a business and organizational development opportunity because they were needing to reinvent themselves, because traditionally maritime welfare organizations were supported by churches with volunteers and with contributions. But nowadays, churches are having their own struggles for volunteers and funds, and that's not the primary source of support anymore. So reinventing themselves and rebranding themselves and creating a larger kind of business value proposition was on the table. And again, that's where I live. That's what I do.
So what is the day-to-day work of the Seafarers Ministry, and how does it relate to both the industries and the very powerful like ILWU unions and the ports?
Our mission is to see after the well-being, both spiritual, physical, and practical needs of international seafarers who call Bay Area ports, primarily the Port of Oakland. We do that through three mechanisms. One, first and foremost, is we go on ship to make ship visits. It is a ministry of hospitality and presence. We go on, if we are permitted, and simply make ourselves available to talk to the seafarers, ask them how they're doing, how's their family, and so forth and so on. We are not inspectors, but we become skilled at asking questions and recognizing if things are going as they should be or not. For example, we always ask how people are doing generally, and we get a general answer. And then we ask more specific questions like, how long have you been a seafarer? And how long have you been on this particular ship? And when are you due to get off? How's the food? And so forth. Those are general questions that you would ask in this context, but they also reveal certain things. For example, if somebody has been on for 8 months, that's beginning to become a red flag, because the best contracts are 4 to 6 months at the most, 4 months at a time. But when you're extending over into 7 and 8 months, fatigue, mental well-being, and safety, both for the individual seafarer as well as the ship, are becoming issues of concern. So we want to delve a little bit more into that. There is nothing that we can do specifically about that, but we pass that information on to the next port of call. We pass that on to the ITF, the International Transport Workers Federation, which represents and has the regulatory authority over how ships, international ships, operate. So ship visiting is the first thing that we do. Second thing that we do is we host seafarers at our International Maritime Center. When they are allowed shore leave, they are able to come to our facility. We have some recreational activities. We are situated in a nice park setting, so they are able to just relax and so forth. If, in fact, they want to go sightseeing or need to go shopping, we are able to provide transportation for them. The third thing that we do is make contact with their families, if that is necessary to be done, and provide other services like taking them to the doctor and seeing after some of their practical needs. So it's those three things.
This is David Helvard for Blue Frontier, the voice for ocean action for over 20 years. This year, with public broadcasting under attack, we continue providing free programming to a number of community radio stations with our Rising Tide Ocean podcast. Rising Tide brings diverse voices of our ocean world to audiences on air and online. Your contribution this Giving Tuesday will help keep this and our other projects afloat. So thank you for your help, and best wishes from the crew at Blue Frontier.
Have you experienced, or have you talked to people who have felt that they've been held against their will, or they were not treated well, or have serious medical conditions that have been pushed under the rug, so to speak?
First of all, if you're out on one of these ships in the middle of the ocean, there's not much you can do. You can't just say, well, hey, I'm out of here, because there's no out for that. But what they experience is that at the end of their contract, let's say that they're halfway between here and China and their contract expires, they get an offer that they don't feel that they can refuse, which is to extend their contract for another 4 months. And there is a sense of loyalty and camaraderie among the seafarers. And if the rest of your friends or the conditions on the boat and on the trips are particularly arduous, you don't want to be the one that skipped bail on your friends and decided to go home while you all have built up this sense of camaraderie and loyalty to one another in the midst of all of these trials. As it relates to illness and so forth, that's an issue that we are working on right now. We have had people who are on ship, one in particular, who had a gallstone and needed to get off. He did not have a visa, did not have a 29-day pass to get off. And technically, foreigners cannot get off a ship because that would be illegal entry into the country. But there are medical exigencies that can, in fact, happen whereby they should be allowed to get off. But medical emergency or humanitarian crisis is determined by CBP, Customs and Border Protection. They are not doctors. They are not diplomats. But they do have their rules, which are pretty well prescribed. And in their defense, they simply are upholding the laws that they are held accountable for, which is they can't get off. If they are able to still work and survive, we don't consider it a medical emergency or a humanitarian crisis that we should exercise our discretion to allow them to get off. We are in very serious conversations with CBP now about ways that we can relax those regulations, which is a federal issue, and local people are not prepared to do that. But we are getting a little bit of leeway to say, well, who else should be and could be involved in the determination of a medical emergency besides you? And we're beginning to get a little bit of give on that, because there are medical professionals and actual maritime medical services that have qualified medical personnel who can make those determinations so that we can get the medical services that we need.
And I've had a kidney stone and gallstones. I mean, this is serious pain. This is not something that you expect a mariner to keep working with, that kind of condition.
Absolutely cannot. And their disposition was that, well, they can take care of that at the next port.
When these ships come in, you know, the container ships or various commercial vessels come into ports, the officers, the Greek, American, English captains may get off, but many of the crew of Filipino, Bangladeshi, Vietnamese crew are kind of stuck on the ship. And so you're really helping facilitate their operations. You have a group of Maritime Academy cadets who are also helping you help the sailors.
Yes, they are some of our good volunteers that work with us in ship visits, as well as some of the special projects that we have coming up. Christmas at Sea. One of the major things that we do is we collect gifts from individuals. This is where our churches and faith-based organizations still support us a lot. A lot of them have knitting programs and so forth. And so we have all year long, they knit caps and gloves and scarves and ditty bags that they send to us around this time of year. As a matter of fact, collections start next week, and we pack those into goody bags along with toiletries and a few snacks and so forth. And from the Saturday after Thanksgiving through January 6th, we deliver those ditty bags to the ships. And every seafarer on board gets their own individual ditty bag for Christmas. We have an effort where we want to make the Port of Oakland the most welcoming port in the world. We have a commitment to visit every ship that calls the Port of Oakland within 8 hours of arrival. And we are doing that by inviting the community to become certified ship visitors. So we recruit people from every walk of life to go through pretty extensive training, get certified, get their TWIC cards from Department of Homeland Security, and become ship visitors. And so we've gone from 250 when we first started this program, which was in 2023, in November 2023, and we're now up to about 370.
And these ships are coming in 24 hours a day. It's not like you just sign up for, you know, the morning session. How do you manage getting people there to greet these ships? It seems very complex.
It is fairly complex. We do have team leaders that we rely on who have their own groups. We've established relationships with the terminal operators, with the shipping agents and so forth, and they look forward to us coming. So hopefully we'll be able to automate most of this in the coming years and be able to fulfill our commitment, because many of the ships are in port for less than 20 hours.
So a lot of this is because automation, just on time delivery with shipping, but also automation's reduced crew size. So a lot of these container ships that are the size of aircraft carriers may have crews of 30 or less. Who are the people, again, we're talking about Filipinos, but the most mariners are not getting off the ship, correct? And how do some get off the ship? And is this becoming more difficult if they have a 3-day layover? Can crew get off the ship? Is it harder now with the crackdown on the borders and immigration?
Yes, it is. There is some fear about getting off because of the inhospitable atmosphere in all of the ports. But 3-day layovers are unheard of, and they do not happen in Bay Area ports because we are second ports of call. No ships come off of the ocean to the Bay Area. They come in to the country either in Seattle or in LA Long Beach. And so we are a second port. So they come here just to pick up, deliver, and go. So they are never here that long. And in the meantime, the decarbonization, which is changing fuels and various other things, as well as automation, is beginning to take place, particularly on some of the older ships where it is very onerous. And the seafarers who are operating these ships currently are being asked to take on various duties that essentially will eliminate their jobs. ITF in particular are very aware of these things and calling for the humane transition to decarbonization, zero emissions, and automation, and so forth and so on. And there's a great deal of concern about the job status, because as we move toward automation, there is the notion that, well, the people whose jobs, they'll just be different, but they won't be out of jobs. Well, that's not necessarily the case. And the jobs that will be created as a result of digitization and automation in maritime, those jobs are being filled now, while the seafarers who have been doing traditional work are still on the ships. So they are not getting trained for those jobs. They are being utilized to transition systems on ship. And then when those systems get in, they're doing the rudimentary work of replacing systems and hauling things around and putting them in place on ships for them to be operated in a remote location by somebody who is being trained for that job now.
Oakland was the first to really automate 4 containers, and that was the first loss of jobs when we went from bulk cargo to containers. And now, as you say, the automation, and along with decarbonization, the automation and the introduction of AI threatens the jobs of all these contract workers, mariners from mostly poorer developing countries. So that has to be a not only an employment issue, but a spiritual issue in terms of people who are at sea much of their lives now realizing that they may lose that part of their lives.
Absolutely. There is very much a spiritual issue with them individually and a huge justice issue for those of us in the spiritual dimension. It is very concerning. And we are involved in conversations all around the world and lending our weight and our networks to lobby and do advocacy in behalf of seafarers.
What's your other big top one or two challenges that you're looking to meet?
The next one is to refurbish our maritime center. I was just reading, there is a thing known as the Seafarers Happiness Index, which comes out of the Mission to Seafarers, also headquartered in London. And they survey seafarers on a quarterly basis on 10 different facets of their lives: food, connectivity on board, shore leave, and the lowest rated areas was access to welfare facilities. Either the ports themselves are very far away from the welfare facilities, or the welfare facilities are inadequately equipped without comfortable and pleasant facilities. A lot of times they are, and even ours, they are containers that are converted into buildings. And ours is very nicely situated in a park right on the water, walking distance from the terminals. So they don't have that problem. But it is about 30 years old now, and we don't have the electronic and technical capabilities that we should have. Wi-Fi is kind of shaky in that area. The decor can be a bit more pleasant and uplifting. That is the most significant issue. And I am working now with several universities and schools that have psychology departments and so forth to try and have in residence at our place people who are competent in mental health counseling and so forth and so on.
I do want to ask you one final question. Since we're talking about sustainability, how do you, in just a couple of sentences, how do you sustain your own spiritual and emotional well-being while you're supporting all of these other people?
Fortunately, I have a very strong network of people. Having been in pastoral ministry as well, I've got a lot of people that look after me, and I have wonderful family that I spend a great deal of time with. I have grandkids who keep me level.
And with that, I really just want to thank you, Robert Wilkins, Senior Executive Director and Chief Program Officer for Seafarers Ministry of the Golden Gate, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Be well.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.